If you look into the politics of what's going on with Ethereum or what's going on in Bitcoin or any network, you will find very strong tribes with, you know, very strong positions competing for resources. This boils down to the problem of governance, how technology can help make governance better, more legitimate, more transparent, more efficient, with better decisions. And it's a huge challenge. You know, it's trying to answer the question, can really the internet improve our democracies?
Hello and welcome to the Community Podcast by CoMatter, a series of conversations that explore how people connect, share, and participate in today's hyperspeed world. My name is Severin Matusek, this is episode 19, and today's guest on the show is Santiago Siri. Santi is the founder of Democracy Earth, an organization that builds open source software that enables democratic voting processes. That sounds quite complicated, but it's actually simple. I'll try and explain it in my own words. It's a set of tools to make democracy more democratic. Or in other words, to enable anyone, from organizations to governments to communities, to make democratic decisions more easily, fair, and direct. Santi's background is as a video game developer, hailing from Argentina, which then led him to become one of the co-founders of Partido de la Red, the Argentinian political party that was founded in 2012 by internet activists and gained quite some traction in Argentinian politics, which then brought him eventually to San Francisco and then New York to build Democracy Earth. So why do we care about democracy on this podcast? I think anyone who has built a community or led a group or was part of some sort of group understands that governance and decision making is hugely important in these groups, but also very difficult. It's very difficult to make everyone's voice being heard. It's very difficult to conduct democratic processes. And it's very difficult to make decisions actually where a majority of people feels involved. And I've seen many communities and groups of people dissolve and break because these processes have not been working out well. So democracy and democratic voting processes are hugely important for building communities. And that's precisely why I wanted to talk to Santi. We talk about the intersection between democracy and the internet, trying to understand how technology can help make governance better and how to deal with issues like power struggles, voting, transparency, participation, and making people care in the democratic systems of today, of the future, as well as in any other community we're building. So we'll get into the conversation in a bit, but before we get started, some housekeeping. We are at CoMatter, who produced this podcast. We're actually thinking a lot about how we can make this podcast more participatory, meaning that we can involve people much more in the way we produce the podcast, in the way we have conversations. So what we're trying for the first time in this podcast is we try to add a little bit more info in our outro and trying to give a few shout outs to people that have been part in the making of this, that led us to have this conversation, that led us to ask certain questions in this conversation, and that also enable you to be part of future conversations. So have a listen to the outro and tell us what you think. You can always get in touch with us. You'll see how in the outro. So let's get back to Santi. Santi and I had a chat earlier in April 2019 between Copenhagen, where I'm based, and New York City, where he's based. It was about 9 a.m. in the morning in New York City. Santi was on a walk in Central Park. So there's a little bit of unpredictability because the weather was it was beginning of spring in New York City, and at some point it started to rain. You'll hear that. But I was very glad that Santi took us on a walk with him through Central Park and answered our questions and got involved in a discussion about democracy and the future of democracy and the internet. So without further ado, here's episode 19 of the Community Podcast with Santiago Siri. Happy Monday, Santiago.
Thank you.
So I hear you're joining us live from Central Park in New York City. Is that right?
Live from Central Park in New York on a Monday that looks very much like the beginning of spring. So it looks very nice here.
Great. So we are here to talk about the future of democracy and your vision on democracy and how you're going to fix it. And but before we're going to start, actually, I would like to know, when was the last time you played a video game?
Oh man, that question. That's a question that hits straight to my heart because I started my career as a game developer. And it's been a long time since I played a video game. I think the last one was probably a Soccer Manager game.
Okay.
That was on my phone. Just to remember the good old times, like a manager where you are the coach of a team and you make decisions And I think I played one of those 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay. But what were the kind of games you developed back when you were a video game developer?
Soccer management games.
Okay. So you basically you were checking on what's new in the world of
soccer.
Yeah,
I mean, being Argentine, soccer is a very big thing in Argentina, and I started my career wanting to make soccer video games. The interesting thing about the video game that I made, like my first game that I got published, was a game where you were able to manage a football team, but also you were able to bribe the referee or give doping to the players. So it was also a game about corruption.
Okay.
And it was actually very interesting. It was a mild success in Russia and in Poland for some reason that I really cannot understand. But yeah, I started my career making games, and I still consider myself a game developer. But
in a different way.
In a different way, with much more real implications.
But that's so interesting, because I think one of the key stones in your biography is that you started Democracy Earth because you grew up in a country that's struck by corruption for decades. And now you tell me you developed a video game with corruption features implemented. That's great.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you realize many years later what you were trying to do. Okay.
I would be interested, before we jump into the details and everything you're working on today, I'm really interested in your story and your history. I know a little bit, you know, you started as a game developer, you are from Argentina, you founded a party in Argentina, and then you started, I think, Democracy Earth a few years ago. But can you give us a little bit of a roundup of the last 10, 15 years of your life?
So 10 years ago, I was probably still managing my second startup. That was a company called Popigo, where we did data mining, big data applied to social media. We worked for some large brands like Unilever, PepsiCo, Mondelez. And I was probably seeing how women talk about straightening their hair on Twitter and giving insights to Unilever about that.
Okay, but what led you then from running a startup that was working with big firms to give them data analytics to founding a party in Argentina, for example? What was the journey there?
Well, actually, there was a shocking moment in the story of that startup, because one day I got a meeting with this guy that came from Mexico that wanted to hire our services for the PRI, which is one of the most important party. Political party in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it was like a bit of a shocker to me, because there was a presidential campaign or some big campaign coming along. They wanted to do good data analysis on all of the candidates. I was very much aware of what the technology or the data really can tell about stuff. And that was a moral choice. You know, I really wasn't willing to. You know, it's one thing to sell this stuff to the Unilevers of this world, which at the end of the day, they are just trying to sell you shampoo. And, you know, that's not a big deal, really. Although there are scary organizations in the sense of how much they understand their consumer. Mm-hmm. But to sell a political candidate, which I had no idea about, and that came also from a very important party, which is very much well known for being extremely corrupt. That was a moral choice, and that confronted me with, you know, the real power of what technology can achieve and what our data can say about society. And that I said no to that. I think around a couple of years later, I was invited for the first time as a young entrepreneur to assist to an event of the World Economic Forum. And it was my first time in that kind of event. I was used to technology conferences. I was never in a conference of the scope of what the WEF can do. And I found myself suddenly surrounded by the King of Spain or the President of Mexico or very, very powerful people. I was invited as a young and coming leader, I guess, from Argentina. I was invited by the Minister of Economy back then. And my first thought being there was, what the hell am I doing here? And what can I do with this? And it was a transition, trying to figure out, you know, I always liked politics. I grew up very much reading history and in love with great iconic heroes of Argentine politics, or figures like Che Guevara and revolutionaries like that. I always wanted to pursue something in politics. I never felt it was my place, because it's definitely a place that has a rhetoric that, you know, belongs to another century. But when I found myself in that event in the WEF, I met other young leaders from different countries in from different places in Latin America. So my friend Giorgio Jackson, he is now congressman of Chile. Back then, I was probably 27, he was probably 25. And it struck me as surprising because Giorgio was the leader of the student movement in Chile coming from the left. But at the same time, he was someone that spoke my language. He spoke about memes, he spoke about digital culture, about Twitter. He understood how to use Twitter. And to me, it was a revelation to see someone very much being a very strong, very popular leader in Chilean politics. He's from Chile, and at the same time speaking a language that really connects with my generation. So when I got back from that trip, in 2012, I decided, you know, I should do something with politics. I should, and instead of selling my technology to politicians, we should try to do a whole new concept of a political party. And in 2012 is when we started the Partido de la Red, along with some colleagues and friends. And we knew that we had an election in 2013. Things started getting crazy really fast. And I think it was a bit of that inspiration of, you know, growing as an entrepreneur, being connected to a community of leaders from my region, from my generation, being inspired by those leaders. Giorgio is still a congressman in Chile, and I think he will be president one day. He's an impressive guy. It was the beginning of the end for me. And in 2012, I also got rid of my company. It was acquired by a larger Brazilian company. I think in 2014, I finally finalized everything related to the for-profit universe. And around that same time as well, the party grew in influence, in power. And the story of the Partido de la Red connected me with the political class in many, many countries. I ended up meeting very interesting people from all around the world. And because we were trying to innovate in a field where no one, absolutely no one, innovates. And the fact that we were able to run for elections in 2013, I think, was a huge achievement on our end. Even though we didn't get the candidate elected, I think that that's a good thing in hindsight. But yeah, we got to learn about how power and politics works in a country like mine, in a region like Latin America. And at the same time, it was this all contemporaneous to the rise of new protocols like Bitcoin that were also an incredible opportunity to start thinking about institutions and technology under a political and economical light like never before.
So was it at the same time while you were running the party or were part of the party in Argentina that you discovered Bitcoin and blockchain? Did this happen like simultaneously?
Yes, pretty much. I recently was tracking how did I find out about Bitcoin, and it was a colleague of mine, Manuel Araos, who is actually the founder of Zeppelin. They are now a big smart contract company. And in 2011, Manu sent me the link of the Bitcoin paper. And I realized this many years later, that was probably him, the first one to tell me about it. I know that I was already into Bitcoin in 2011. I used to do a radio column in Buenos Aires, and there's one from February 2012, but this is a mainstream radio show, and I'm telling everyone in the radio, there's this thing called Bitcoin, and watch out, it's very expensive, it's $4. It used to be $1.
Yeah.
So don't put all your money in it.
Okay.
And that kind of made me like a Bitcoin wizard in Argentina.
Okay, I see. What happened then? So just I think for our listeners, it's also important to know, and I only found this out in my research yesterday, Partido de la Red means actually party of the internet, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So you very much identified as the young generation that understands the internet, that understands a certain communication, democracy processes that only run through the internet. And you kind of like wanted to reach similar young people that probably couldn't be reached by the traditional political parties, right?
Yes, and you know, the young people that were asking simple questions like, why can't we tell our congressmen how to vote over the internet? You know, the stuff that now, I probably can understand better why it might sound naive to the political class, but I still think it's these are simple goals worth pursuing. And, you know, today I know I'm aware of many similar parties that are all of us very small because we're independent parties trying to grow outside the establishment. And but there's a new wave of parties, pretty much like the green parties, probably in the after the 60s and 70s. I think that the rise of digital parties since the Pirate Party in Germany, there's a new wave of ways of trying to engage with politics because we have better tools for transparency and for managing the finances and and committing our decisions to our promises.
Yeah. And so just to finish with the history part, so after you were part of creating the party in Argentina, at some point you realized there's actually room for more. You can build, you know, this democracy OS, I think you called it in 2015, an operating system for democracy. And you started that in Argentina, but also at some point, I think you ended up in Silicon Valley or then in New York. Like, how was this transition from moving from Argentina to the US to build what you're building today?
Democracy OS was the first version of our software. Our philosophy was to do simply, well, if we're going to do software for democracy, it needs to be open source. Mm-hmm. So we started with that. It's just like a very simple version of Facebook where people just post content, you debate, and you vote. Mm-hmm. And we saw very rapidly the software being implemented in many different contexts around the world. We saw Tunisian NGOs suddenly translating the software to Arabic and using it to debate the new Tunisian constitution after the Arab Spring. We saw the Senate of Mexico using it. We saw a political party in Spain. So there was clearly a demand for this type of tools in politics. And in 2014, we did two things. One was we got invited to do a global TED Talk, which gave us a lot of international exposure. So we got to tell the story of our party to the world. We ended up applying to Y Combinator and we got accepted. And that's when YC accepts us. It's the opportunity to start working with the best technologies in the world, being connected to an extraordinary network of people that have been thinking about this for many years. So we fly in 2015, we fly to Silicon Valley. I live 2 years in San Francisco. And that's where we started the Democracy Earth Foundation, okay. Putting a much, much stronger emphasis on the technology. And of course, taking the opportunity of what blockchain-based networks allow in terms of creating systems of governance.
Okay. And is this story true? I just read this story in an article the other day that you were pitching to Y Combinator and you were kind of like inventing numbers and weren't doing that well. But at some point you were showing this Instagram picture of your party in Argentina where you constructed this huge Trojan horse out of wood and had it on the streets and basically used this as a way to run the elections or something. And that's what got you into Y Combinator. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. The process of application to Y Combinator is very weird because it's only a 10-minute interview and it's 10 minutes stops. So you have 10 minutes to awe the partners. I think that, you know, they're trying to measure how fast you can react to their questions. They were asking us questions like, how many users do you have? And, you know, you throw out a number and you really have no real idea because you are just so stressed in the moment. And then there's many of those users are recurrent users. And then you throw another number and you're just like, you're thinking inside, I blew it, this is not working. Until we, at the end of those 10 minutes, we tell them, oh, and we also did a Trojan horse. And we start, you know, showing them the pictures of the Trojan horse through the streets of Buenos Aires. And that really got them on the edge of their seats. And it was incredible because then they saw that we were not just some nerds doing politics over social media, but we were actually trying to, you know, really do a party, really be on the streets. And we got to tell them, obviously, everything that we have achieved with the party, that doing a political party is way harder than any kind of institution that you can imagine. It's harder than NGOs, harder than companies, harder than anything else. And I think YC was really appreciative of that, got us into the program. And that you know, we started thinking along the lines of Democracy Earth.
Okay. So maybe now is a good time to actually talk about Democracy Earth and what you're building right now. And I want to give a bit of context of why I'm interested in that, actually, because normally on this podcast, we talk to people who build communities, and, you know, communities can be around brands, communities can be online, can be offline, can be social movements. We recently had Harper Reed on a podcast who talked about how they did the 2012 Barack Obama re-election campaign, and we talked a little bit about that. So the reason why I'm interested in Democracy Earth and what you're building is that the way I look at the internet and the way I look at communities is that there's actually no difference between movements and communities in the real world, as in a political party, and these movements and communities in the digital world. Like, I think we face the same challenges and problems in both sides, which is power struggles, which is democratic voting processes, which is transparency, which is activating people, engaging people, making people care, dealing with spaces where nobody cares at all anymore, or dealing with people that have taken all the control into their hands and not let anyone else participate. So all of these problems, I think, exist exactly in the same way online in whatever community or group you're part of as they exist offline. And I see Democracy Earth as an attempt to solve some of these problems on a government level, but also on a political party level, but also maybe on a simple, how do we interact with each other online level? So can you give me your view on the purpose of Democracy Earth and what you're trying to build?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Humans are very hard. Mm-hmm. We experience a lot of the issues you mentioned also with our party. You know, there suddenly, you know, you find yourself with a lot of attention, and there's power struggles emerge, historical divisions in society that maybe were not present at the beginning because everyone was focused in a goal. After that goal is achieved, then those divisions, call them, you know, Democrats or Republicans, or call them left or right or whatever, but those divisions naturally emerge. When dealing with politics, it's very much important to also understand the historical legacy and the historical context that you're within. And I think crypto networks are facing that process as well. Again, if you look into the politics of what's going on with Ethereum or what's going on in Bitcoin or any network, you will find very strong tribes with, you know, very strong positions competing for resources. So this boils down to the problem of governance, how technology can help make governance better, more legitimate, more transparent, more efficient, with better decisions. And it's a huge challenge. You know, it's trying to answer the question, can really the internet improve our democracies? You know, that's where we started from. And I'd say, you know, we have tremendous potential with these technologies. But at the same time, you know, what we try to bring to the whole space is trying to understand what democracy means in this context. Mm-hmm. If you look at all of the crypto projects out there, they're all of them fundamentally coin voting, or, you know, the more stake you have on a network, the more influential you become in that network. So really, every single network out there is pretty much plutocratic. And what we're trying to figure out is, well, you know, how can you deploy democracies over the internet that can be censorship resistant? And, you know, today what we're focused on is we are providers of governance infrastructure to existing crypto networks. We are working with two very big ones like Blockstack and Decentraland. Mm-hmm. And we obviously, you know, understand the conflicts and the challenges that happen within their communities. But we hope to make the decisions emerging from these communities, the best ones and the most legitimate ones. I think democracy has this ability to guarantee legitimacy. And when the disagreements are very strong, the more important democracy becomes. And I think very few networks have found themselves in under very strong disagreements. I can remember probably the block size debate in Bitcoin. Now Ethereum is you know, having interesting conversations, but eventually, you know, we democracy, because we need to come to a decision that involves every the whole constituency. So our research and our technology is very much aimed at that goal, trying to understand, well, you know, what are the best designs and technical choices that can help deploy democracies over the internet that cannot be censored.
Mm-hmm. So does this mean when a group of, let's say, 50 people can't agree on something, and they could discuss forever about why we should take this decision or that decision, does your technology help with finding a decision and trying to find a consensus so everybody gets heard and everybody feels like they have been part of the process?
Well, I can tell you stories about that. You know, we have made many implementations, and in some of these we have faced very strong decisions. Actually, in the party itself in 2017, we had a very strong, very important decision to make. That was whether we would allow for the party to make alliances with other parties or not in the elections of that year. Mm-hmm. And that raised very strong feelings. You know, I would say that 50% of the party was against it. I was in that camp, by the way. Mm-hmm. And 50% of the party was in favor, because obviously they had already planned an alliance with a party. So that led to a vote using Democracy OS, the first version of our software, which was not blockchain-based. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that election was that it was the most popular decision we ever faced as a party. We had, like, the party had 1,200 affiliates, but, you know, 100 people voted. And, you know, usually our decisions were decided between 30 or 40 participants. This one was very high stakes. And what we found out was that the sysadmin, who had the responsibility of controlling the database with the affiliates and the registrations, was accelerating certain people to register and their family members and delaying certain people to register. So this behavior, this single point of failure that was, you know, the person responsible for approving or disapproving identities, had an effect in the outcome of the election. The outcome of that election was that finally the party decided to allow alliances with other parties. Mm-hmm. So that was the decision made. But, you know, politics is very funny. You know, people put a lot of emphasis on the vote, put a lot of emphasis on the outcome of the vote, but, you know, it's really everything that happens around the vote that sometimes can be way more relevant than that single choice or that single decision. What ended up happening with the party back then was that, the party agreed to make alliances with other parties. So our side went to do alliances with other parties. Yeah. And we ended up doing an alliance with the largest party in the country, which led to having a candidate in the list of national Congress candidates in 2017, and in a list of candidates that got almost 50% of the votes in 2017. Almost, no, it got 51% of the votes. So it was one of those things that backfired to the ones that were pushing for this strategy.
Yeah.
And that's politics. You know, sometimes a decision helps to unlock or unleash a potential that would otherwise not be unleashed. But obviously the consequences are felt. You know, people, it's like when someone you don't like wins or when someone you like wins, and your perception within that organization or institution changes. And in crypto, we have these interesting situations where people are using the card of forking to have some leverage to negotiate developer rewards. Mm. Or, you know, different strategies to fund different initiatives. And again, these are the cards that you are left to play in context of power. And power is the same everywhere. So I think we're beginning to understand the geography of power in the digital spectrum, how power behaves, how power works, what information allows on in terms of building digital institutions. Mm. But power is the same everywhere, and the thing that we should all be very much aware about the nature of power is that power corrupts, and that's something that it is extremely important to be conscious, to be aware of. And in crypto, most of the people are very young, very naive. I used to be very young and naive. I'm 35 now and still consider myself a bit young, but not that naive anymore. And I think that it's understanding the nature of power is very relevant. And hopefully, we build these systems to prevent corruption, to have better checks and balances that can help more institutions run better. My personal fight is against a very corrupt system like Argentina that I saw very, very dark things happening. And so that's why I'm willing to bet on technology in order to prevent the kind of corruption that I witness in my own country. Mm-hmm.
Do you think democracy is the only option? Or do you also think other forms of governance might arise in the future that could potentially replace democratic processes?
I think, people talk about different forms of democracy, like liquid democracy, direct democracy, representative democracy, deliberative, whatever. But at the end of the day, it's just democracy, period. And democracy is really a work in progress. It's never a complete or absolute idea. Otherwise, it would be a totalitarian ideology, just like every other ideology in the political spectrum. Democracy is the one exception. It's the ideology of how we make decisions. It's not a strict agenda of how to move forward. It's actually the one that embraces asking questions, the one that embraces free speech, that one that embraces diversity. I think that it is a very powerful tool. It can be used with very dangerous outcomes. I agree with that. Hitler was elected. I think that we need to understand the nature of democracy very profoundly, but making decisions coming from the elites, giving their back to the people, is rarely a good thing. I think the nice thing about democracy is that it's able to or has this ambition to include everyone's voices in the decision-making process and make sure that these decisions are taking into account the needs of the majority. Maybe we find in the future something better. Maybe there are new versions of what I'm talking about that can really distill this in a much more elegant way. I'm right now working with something called quadratic voting that is a different way of tallying the votes, of calculating the votes, that maybe that holds some promise to make good decisions while at the same time guaranteeing that has a wider impact in the constituency. But I think we need to keep on researching. Democracy is never finished. It's always a work in progress, and it's very interesting politically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking the question because obviously I agree with you, and I think most of our listeners will agree with you that democracy is probably the best form of governance we have found so far as a human society. I was just inspired because recently I interviewed a Brazilian film director, Petra Costa, on the podcast, and she's done an amazing documentary about democracy in Brazil, basically following the elections over years and years. Seeing what was going on in Brazil. And she called her movie that I think will be released in June or something called The Edge of Democracy. And her story is she thought she grew up with having democracy granted and having it granted that democracy is a form that the majority of people will benefit from. But her experience in Brazil over the last 5 to 10 years has showed her that she's not sure anymore if a majority of people agrees that democracy is the right form of governing and that a lot of people want to go back to, one leader taking certain decisions by themselves. So I wondered, Do you think we are in a crisis of democracy right now worldwide, with a lot of people not believing in democracy anymore and longing for other forms of government? And if so, how could this be changed?
I think so, yes. I mean, the election of Donald Trump took the world by surprise. In Brazil, we saw the election of Bolsonaro, who is a former military guy. At the same time, I would argue that, you know, democracy working very well is effectively allowing the emergence of outsiders of the establishment to take power. And in that respect, Donald Trump was not a Washington guy. Bolsonaro was a fringe politician coming from the Brazilian right. So, you know, that the fact that they were elected means that at least these democratic systems are allowing for novelty or allowing for change. And, you know, that's where democracy is actually very dynamic. It is the one system that can cope with change. Otherwise, if we would be having the Hillary Clintons of the world, of this world, constantly being in power, the Clintons and the Bushes, is that really a democracy? I don't know. I really don't think so. Of course, Donald Trump is a product of the elite. The thing about the democratic systems out of all of the democracies in the world, of what we call democracies today in the world, are really systems of legitimization, where it's the elites who choose the candidates, and then these get legitimized with society. But the society never really elects anyone. These systems are really not really bottom up. They're pretty much top down. So today, with the rise of social media and the internet, we are seeing more polarization. I think more and more people in social media try to follow only those who agree with you, or only those that share your same views, which leads to endogamy and echo chambers and fanatism, you know, a much more fanatical way of looking at reality, which leads to the polarization that we perceive pretty much in every democracy around the world today. And this is a consequence of the emergence of new communication, new technology, and it's not dissimilar to other periods in history. The rise of the radio and telecommunication in the early 20th century eventually led to the rise of fascism and communism and radical agendas that took power and stayed in power for a very, very long time. I think that democracy is a system that, when it has strong institutions, can allow for some of these experiments. You can have a fascist in power for 4 years, 8 the maximum, but then you have to change. And, you know, the virtue of alternation can work very well. And I can relate to that to the story of my own country. My country has a very young democracy. It has my age. The democracy of Argentina is 35 years old. And it's very weak and very challenged by very strong, political, powerful entities. And in 2015, we had an alternation in power. Suddenly, someone, after 12 years of the same type of government, we suddenly changed the national government with someone that was coming from a completely different angle. And that, you know, this new government is helping put a lot of corrupt people in jail. And hopefully trying to, you know, purge a little bit of the corruption happening in the state. I don't think it's, by any means, I don't think it's, you know, the most clean government in the world at all. But it's this alternation of power that allows keeping each side in check. We all have two hemispheres in our brains, and we all have a little communist and a little fascist hidden inside that brain. So I think that the best way to keep the communists and the fascists in check is certainly by allowing for some alternation in power, and that puts risk to whoever is in power, that if someone does not good, then justice will take care of your actions. So in that sense, I think democracy is a very good tool.
Yeah. So moving forward, what is your dream with Democracy Earth? Do you dream of governments implementing the technologies that you're building in their countries? Are you dreaming online and offline movements implementing some of these systems of governance into their dynamics. What do you dream of if you really think big with Democracy Earth? Where could it be in 5 or 10 years from now? At this point in our conversation, it started raining like crazy in Central Park, and Santi's connection went from flimsy to terrible within a minute. So we cut the interview short, and after that, I asked Santi to send me his answer over WhatsApp. So here's the recording in a WhatsApp voice message.
Severin, my friend, here I am back, ready to answer your last question. What a pity yesterday that we got the rain. I should have paid attention to your email instructions of being in a peaceful place and whatnot. But I shit you not, it was a beautiful day. It was in the middle of the park. I have done several interviews. Anyway, I should learn the lesson. That said, I will proceed to answer the last question. So what's your dream for Democracy Earth in 10 years? Answer in a voice message, upside down smiley face. After working in the space of trying to understand this intersection between democracy and the internet, really it boils down today to understand how we can formalize human rights in decentralized networks. And the idea of human rights here is really not an abstraction. It's a very tangible necessity for allowing a much more fair governance of these powers of structure that are blockchain-based networks. This relates and connects very much to the idea of how we do identity over blockchain-based networks. Now, the risk of doing identity or putting the full information about us in an immutable ledger is that we run the risk that if that information goes in the wrong hands, it can be used for coercion. So we need to find a way where we can effectively formalize identity by expressing that the entity behind a given address is effectively a human being and not either a civil or an artificial intelligence, a robot or a bot, some kind of proxy. In order to do this, we need to understand how to create this new social contract, this new shared understanding of, okay, this is an address that I can trust, that is a human, and that human doesn't control other addresses in the consensus of this network. Because in our research, as I have mentioned before, we have found, not in our research, in our practical implementations, we have found that if the entity giving voter rights in a democracy is centralized, that entity can have a very strong influence in the outcome of any democratic election. So we need to understand how to decentralize allocation of voter rights. And in order to scale to a planetary level or to the whole Earth, we need to make sure that protocol is strictly focused on improving that there's a human behind the screen and that, you know, that human doesn't hold other keys. So that's how I see the fundamental problem of what we're trying to deal with today and how that can lead us to better outcomes tomorrow. Just a piece of news about today. We just announced that Democracy Earth did the software for quadratic voting that was implemented by the state of Colorado. And this is a state that has put on the line under this new type of election method, $154 million worth of budget for the year 2019 to 2021. 41 legislators participated and voted over 107 bills. So it is really interesting on our end that we're starting to see some very empirical implementations with real money at stake in these decision mechanisms, and that these are leading to very interesting results.
Thank you, Santi, for joining this conversation and sharing your view on democracy. If you, dear listener, are interested in hearing more about this, go and follow Santiago on Twitter. His Twitter handle is SantiSiri, and check out Democracy Earth. That's democracy.earth. Now, this is the time for the outro, where we actually wanted to give a few notes on how this show is being produced and who has given us feedback and was part of making this episode happen. So first of all, thanks to the Blockstack conference that happened in Berlin early last year in 2018, which is where Santi actually spoke on stage and where I met him afterwards and had a very interesting conversation about a lot of the stuff that we actually talked about now, but which really made me curious to talk and dive deeper into this conversation, which we have done now about a year later. I also want to thank Sabina, the amazing producer of this podcast who helps us get these episodes live and edit them and make them happen. I want to thank to Martin, who's always giving us a lot of valuable feedback for these podcasts. Martin is a curator based in Malmö, Sweden, actually working on a super interesting conference happening this June in Beirut. It's called Ours Beirut. Go and check it out. And Martin is also one of the people who actually continues to introduce us to interesting people for this podcast. So he was the one introducing us to Claire L. Evans, who we spoke to very early this year about feminism and the female pioneers of the internet. I want to thank Ido, who got back to us after one of our most recent episodes and gave us a few technical tips and tricks on how we can avoid these little bumps in our microphone. I hope this is actually getting better. And thank you to all the other listeners who actually tune in every other week to listen to this podcast and email us with suggestions and ideas afterwards. So if you are one of them, if you have any suggestions, questions, feedback about these conversations that we're having here, feel free to get in touch. My email is severin@comatter.com. That's co-matter.com. Get in touch anytime. Tell us what you think. And we will happily give you a shout out in the next episode. So we have a few new episodes in the pipeline that are going to be released in the next few weeks. One of them that I'm really excited about is about food and the food scene in Copenhagen, taking a look at what's happening back in the kitchen and about how collaboration processes and community processes are being a huge part of modern restaurants today. And yeah, that's it so far. We would love to hear from you and give you a shout out in this outro and make this outro a little bit more transparent and participatory. Because in the end, participation is everything we care about and we believe in. So feel free to get in touch. Severin@comatter.com, co-matter.com. Subscribe to this podcast if you haven't done it yet. We are releasing new episodes almost every 2 weeks with interesting people to talk about communities, the internet, participation processes, blockchains, and so on. And yeah, see you next time. Thank you very much and bye.